be live. So I actually started because I wanted to do exactly what I'm doing, trying to address the situations that are going on. Mm-hmm. You know, being a member of the Black community, you see how much problems people don't like the police and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, me being in law enforcement, I said, you know what, I want to try to help solve this problem. And so I said, I'm going to try to do it. And I thought about the best way to go about that. And so I'm listening to other people. I always like listening to podcasts when I'm going for walks or working out or something like that. And so I said, I'm listening to people who are talking about nothing or getting political stuff wrong and all this kind of stuff. I said, you know what, I got something to say, so why don't I try to say it? And so that kind of jumped.
Good for you. Good. Yeah. Well, we've just been talking about that lately.
About what?
A podcast. Sheree and I have been talking because we said so many people have so much to say, and a lot of time misinformation is spread that the right people need to really be on the mic.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. The right people need to be up here saying stuff. And there's a lot of bad information out there. There's a lot of people who think that they know. I always hear these people saying law enforcement should do this, that, and the other, and have no experience and don't know what they're talking about or why we make the decisions that we do. Mm-hmm. And I've had some conversations with some people last couple of days and able to say, listen, this is why the officers did what they did. And this is why, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they either understand it or they don't. So I hope you don't mind. I just sent you Sheree, a friend request.
Okay. I'm glad you told me that because I don't ever look at them, and I think I have like over 1,000. So I'll go look back at.
You don't have to do well.
No, I'll do it.
And I am actually under my name is Shantae Owens too. So
I thought I had you on here, but maybe
is this better? The lighting?
Oh, it's much better. Oh yes.
My husband. Thank you.
I think this is you. It's a picture of you. Oh, yeah, this is you.
Huh? Do you have a banker lamp? That's what this is.
I'm already friends with you, Shantae. Shantae, right? Serious? Yeah, you
probably. Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay.
All right. It's all good. It's all good. So we'll wait a few more minutes here. We got a couple of people who are looking at it.
Okay, sure.
And I want to make sure that that a couple of people are on here. So before we start talking about the important stuff, so. So it's hot. I take it it's hot down there. And
oh my gosh.
Very hot.
Humid.
Very hot
and humid.
Yeah.
How was the weather there?
So it's only like 85 degrees though, because it rained today, but normally it's been like between 90 and 95.
But it feels much hotter than 80 something degrees because it's so humid. Yeah. So how was the weather in Connecticut?
Today it hit 90. They've been calling it a heat wave, so it hit 90 today. Yeah, that's probably nothing. That's probably a walk in the park for you guys. You guys got long sleeve shirts on in 90 degree weather, right?
Yeah. Well, it was 98 last Friday morning when we were at the pool. Yeah.
Or what about Saturday? She got up to run late. We normally run on Saturday mornings, and I think you were running. It was like 99 degrees by the time
it was about 10:30 a.m. and it was 99.
All right, so we got a couple people here, so we'll start off. So I want to welcome my special guest here, Shantae Owens and Sheree Grant, twin judges. I thank you guys so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
So Judge Owens was on the podcast before, and I really, really appreciate you coming back, and I was very, very upset because I found out after the show that you have a twin sister. And not only do you have a twin sister, but you're both are judges. You guys are certainly a psychological experiment. Because I actually went back to school for psychology, and we always talked about twin studies and all that kind of stuff and how many times they go in the same path. And lo and behold, I got it right here in front of me. So that's actually awesome. So I would encourage people to go back and listen to the episodes and the podcast for the audio podcast, Captain Hunter's podcast. It's available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and all that kind of stuff. It's just an audio podcast, but go back and listen to it. And there, Judge Shante gave us her background, her pedigree, minus the part that she has a twin sister and all that kind of good stuff. And I cannot believe all the stuff that you were involved in. And I'm certainly, I couldn't even believe that you had time to sleep and raise kids and have a husband and all the women's work that you were doing. It was unbelievable just to hear all that. I couldn't believe what I was reading when I read your bio. So I'm interested in hearing all that again, but I'm also interested in hearing about Judge Sheree and what you've got going on and stuff and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to start with Judge Sheree because I'm still kind of mad at Judge Owens. So Judge Sheree, please tell us about yourself.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm Sheree Grant, and as you said, I'm one of the district court judges here in Birmingham, Alabama. A lot of what you probably know about Shante, I'll probably say the same. We both graduated from the same college, Alabama State University. We both graduated from LSU Law School together, and after that, we ended up moving. We separated at that time. Shante went back to Alabama and I moved to Atlanta. And I started practicing law in Atlanta right after law school. So I practiced there for about 9 years. Then moved back to Birmingham. While I was in Atlanta, I was a prosecutor with the city of Atlanta and then with the DeKalb DA's office. I rose to several positions in that office. Before I left, I was the deputy chief assistant for the juvenile court. And I was also the domestic violence sexual assault prosecutor, moved back to Birmingham and switched to the other side and started defending cases and doing some other civil work. So I've been a prosecutor and then I've been a criminal defense attorney. So I've been able to see things on both sides. And right before taking the bench, I was a public defender. I helped start an office. Birmingham, Alabama had never had a public defender's office before. And so the public defender at the time was a young black female, Kyra Fontenot, and she asked me to help her come and set the office up. And so we set up an office from the ground up, not really having a model. We had to go look around the country, other places. We actually model our office after the Bronx defenders. And after that, I did that for 3 years. And then I ended up going to the bench. I was appointed by the governor on the bench. I'm a district civil judge. My sister is a criminal court judge. So I do the civil cases, a lot of car accidents, evictions, any of those sorts. And I'm on a few boards. I'm a member of the Alabama State Foundation Board. I'm on the Renaissance Prep School of Excellence Academy Board. That is a school that is that has just been started for children, and it goes up to the 12th grade. It's a very unique school, so I'm excited to now be on that board. And I'm a former board member for Growing Kings, which was a male mentor organization where we help the wayward youth within the city limits with programs, wonderful, wonderful programs. So I'm excited to be doing what I do, and I think the most important thing is that we both give service. We're both of service. And I think that's what our mom taught us the most, to be of service.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you so much. Judge Owens.
All right. I'm Shante Owens. Thanks so much for having me back. I am currently a circuit court judge in the criminal division in Birmingham, Alabama. This is my 12th year on the bench. For 10 years, I was a district court criminal judge. And about maybe a year and a half ago, the governor appointed me to a circuit court position. So now I preside over circuit court cases, but I am still in the criminal division. I'm a former prosecutor with the Jefferson County DA's office, which is the largest district attorney's office in the state of Alabama, because Jefferson County, where Birmingham sits, is the largest county in the state of Alabama. My legal career has been totally in the criminal arena. I have been a prosecutor and then I took the bench. And I think what Sheree also failed to mention is that we both have girls and we both have boys. We have 11-year-old girls, and we have seven. Well, actually, my daughter is 10. I have a 10-year-old daughter. Her daughter just turned 11, and we both have 7-year-old little boys. Our girls are 4 months apart, and our boys are 4 months apart. Yes. Right. We're very close. Yeah.
And we live around the corner from each other.
Psychological experiment right there, ladies and gentlemen.
And we're married to best friends.
I'm sure. They're probably brothers or sisters, brothers, and it's crazy.
Yeah, they're best friends. Our best husbands friends. Are best friends, yes.
Wow, wow. That is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. So I guess this is a question to both of you, but I can probably ask one. What made you decide to enter the legal field, to become lawyers? It's got to be the same answer, right?
I was going to say, as long as I can remember, I've only ever wanted to be two things. I wanted to be a news reporter or a lawyer. And when I got to law school, I remember thinking, wow, I want to do something where I'm going to be in the courtroom. Like, I wasn't really focused on, I'm a firm believer that if you do what you're passionate about, the money will come. So I wasn't really focused on working at a big law firm, making lots of money. I was focused on being in the courtroom litigating. And the prosecutor's office was the best place for me to go. I actually interned there my first year of law school, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. And I've just always had a love for criminal law. So that's how, you know, I've always wanted to either be a news reporter or a lawyer. So
I was going to say, I think we both have always wanted to, I can think at least from the fifth or sixth grade, we both wanted to be lawyers, but I wanted to be either a lawyer or a psychiatrist. And so when you said something about psychology, I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. But I think also my mom always talked to us about helping our community. And that was one of the reasons why I thought, wow, one way I really can help our community, one way I can help people is by being a lawyer. And as Shantae said, I know this sounds funny, but after the first year of law school, I interned with the prosecutor's office in Atlanta and knew that was exactly what I wanted to do too. I know it sounds corny.
You guys gotta be trolling me. This can't be real. This can't. All right. So were you guys, this is probably a silly question, were you guys competitive growing up?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And even now, we're silently competitive. And it's so funny. We run together every Saturday morning. And Sheree is so competitive. If I start to edge up on her, she'll run a little faster. I always notice it. But we've always been competitive, but we call it healthy competition. Yeah. And when one of us reach, you know, an achievement, then, you know, the other, we just kind of, we're always kind of building upon each other.
Yeah, I think we've always had really good, healthy competition, even if we haven't done the same things, but we're always trying to see, well, what are you doing? Like Shantae has been a member of a number of organizations that I'm not necessarily a member of, but she's been very helpful in other endeavors that I want to do. So we always have a very good, healthy competition, I think, going on.
Very nice. So who had the better grades?
But that's not true. Our grades were around the same. If she made a 93, I would make like either a 94 or a 92. She believes she much better grades, and that's just not true.
This is what I say, and this is the truth, and in no shade, Sheree. But my grades were just slightly higher, but not by much, just 1 or 2 points. But she just won't admit it, but just 1 or 2 points.
We both graduated summa cum laude from undergrad. We both did. But I think she wants to say, well, what was your GPA? Because you barely made it, you know, summa. I think her grades were the same, but she continues to say she was a little better.
So she slightly.
She counts the decimal points out to the fifth to
absolutely.
The fifth one.
Yeah. That thousand place.
Judge Sheree, I want to ask you, you sit on civil courts. We're going to get into this, to legal aspects of all that's going on here. So can you tell us anything that you've done, as far as police misconduct cases? Have you done anything like that or lawsuits or anything like that?
Well, I haven't had a police misconduct case. What I have had are, I've dealt with a lot of eviction cases where the police may have mishandled people when they arrested them. And so the criminal case is sort of bifurcated, and it's sort of, so I don't really get to deal with the criminal case of the police officer, but we do take some of that testimony when we're deciding whether or not this person should be evicted. So that's where I have dealt with that, but I haven't dealt with the criminal case, and I have not, I mean, with the criminal case, and I haven't had any civil cases yet on police, any of the police mishandling people. However, I believe we probably will start to see more and more of that. I think people are going to start to speak out more and more, and so I think we'll start to see it.
John Shante, in your time and sitting on the bench there, or even both of you are prosecutors, I can come back to you also, Sheree. How has that been as far as police officers, their testimonies, people, are they believable? Things like that.
Okay. Wow. That's a loaded question, Captain Hunter. I mean, it really is, because I talk about this a lot. When I was a prosecutor, one of the things I used to do before I took the bench, I would train new officers. Like, we would train them on the criminal code, and I would go and I would teach a class ever so often. And we would also talk to them about, when you come to court, how you should present yourself before the, you know, before the jury. I've been a little disappointed these days in what I see as a judge, and I've just been a little disappointed in what I think is a lack of familiarity with the case, a lack of professionalism, and it really hurts the state's case because, you know, in a criminal case, the police, outside of the victim, is the most important witness to that case. And if the police comes in with a very relaxed or unprofessional attitude, it really hurts the case. And especially in the days in which we're living in, where people are scrutinizing police officers a lot more. And so those are the things that I'm seeing. And I actually reached out to someone with our local police department and said, hey, I would love to have a class or do something so that I can talk to officers about just courtroom demeanor. I don't want to tell you how to testify, because I don't want to shape testimony, but I do want to tell you about professionalism, courtroom demeanor, and what it looks like. So those are some of the things that I'm seeing with police officers coming in. And that doesn't speak for everyone, because there are some outstanding officers who do a great job when they come to court. But then there are, from my perspective, a bit too many of those who just, I don't think they understand the gravity of their demeanor, their appearance, and their testimony when they're in the courtroom.
I think you make a great point. If I could piggyback off that, although I'm in the civil court, I deal with police officers on eviction cases and accident cases. And not too long ago, I had a personal injury case where the plaintiff had a police officer as their witness. Well, we were waiting on him. He said that he wasn't coming, and we didn't understand why he wasn't coming, because he had been subpoenaed. And so I called him, the judge, and he said, yeah, I'm not coming. And I said, well, sir, I'm not sure if you understand. This is the judge calling you. He said, yeah, I'm aware of who you are. So we took a recess. I called his sergeant. He was in my courtroom 15 minutes later, but he came in with such a lackadaisical approach. And I told the plaintiff, I said, I understand that you guys want to give so much weight and credibility to a police officer's testimony, but if you look at this, they ask others to obey the law, and they ask others to follow a lawful subpoena. But here we have the police officer who, in fact, knew I was a judge, on the phone with him, and who said he wasn't coming. And so I think for me, the most important thing for me is now I think I hold their testimony as the same weight as I hold anyone else. There is, they don't get more credibility with me anymore. I mean, and I think that also comes from, organically comes from being a prosecutor, now a defense attorney, and having seen certain things. And that's not to say that's all police officers, because I have police officers all the time in my courtroom. And as Shante said, you know, we have some really good police officers that come in and testify. Their demeanors are good. But I am starting to see, with the younger generation of police officers, a completely lackadaisical approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was certainly a problem before I left, where we were dealing with officers who were, you know, 25 and under, which is like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
They just didn't get it. So the believability, you guys talked about that a little bit. Officer's testimony, is that really a big problem? I mean, here's what I'm asking. Have you ever had a case where you just thought that the officer was just lying, just totally made up nonsense? Has that ever come up?
I can't say that I think that I've ever had a case where I thought the officer was totally lying nonsense. I can't say me personally, you know, and if I were across my days before I took the bench, if I thought an officer was lying, then I would dismiss the case or I wouldn't put that person on the stand as a prosecutor. But as a judge, I can't say that I had a case where I thought the officer was just totally lying. Now, I have had cases where I thought maybe the truth was stretched just a little bit, or there was some standard language that is commonly used that he or she just decided to use. But I see lying as an issue from my perspective, as much as I see just a lazy attitude towards not really understanding the gravity of your job and what you do and all the power that you have, you know. But I'm sure Sheree would disagree, having been a criminal defense attorney. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, I have certainly felt like officers have been completely lying. And also, when I was a prosecutor, I've had cases where the tape would click on and off. And I'm like, why are we clicking the tape? What's going on? And I thought that they were lying and doing some things, and I've had to dismiss those cases as well. As a defense attorney, I have definitely thought I've had some cases where officers were telling the truth and my clients were lying, but also they were lying as well. And so, yeah, I've seen it in both ways, and I think that's probably what has shaped me to make sure to give that credibility to a lay witness, a regular witness off the street, as I would with an officer. Now, having said that, I'm not saying that every single case, all of a sudden, an officer is lying, because I think even as defense attorneys, we know sometimes when our clients are not necessarily giving us the full story, but it's our job to give them the best defense. But yes, I have had those cases.
Very good. So we're dealing with some troubling times here. Well, before we get into that, how have you guys been handling the COVID-19 as far as work and home? Are you guys making out okay and all that?
Wow. Yeah. It's been chaotic, and it's been very hard to try to even to hold court in the midst of all of this, because our in-court person proceedings have been suspended until July 15th due to the pandemic. And so I'm a criminal court judge, and our Supreme Court order really does not allow us to do much over Zoom, whereby the civil judges, as Sheree, she has conducted trials and she's done some other things using Zoom, but I can't because of constitutional considerations. And so for me, I have people who really want to get their criminal cases resolved that we can't really resolve right now. And I've really released most nonviolent offenders. So most of my defendants who are pending on my docket are people who are probably, if convicted, going to go to prison for some significant amount of time.
Yeah, I think the COVID-19 pandemic has opened up a lot of issues in the court system and how we handle things. And I think it has helped us in a way. It's brought us up to date with some technological things that we should have been doing a while ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we should have been holding certain hearings a while ago. I think probably the thing that has probably really hurt my court the most are the eviction cases, because when the pandemic came, there was a moratorium on evictions as well. And so we had to stop all of the evictions, which is a good thing. You know, we can't put people out on the street during this time. But we are slowly, after the moratorium has been lifted, we are slowly trying to come back and try those cases. And so we're getting a lot of push from landlords who want people out, but the pandemic is still here. And so trying to make that balance has been, I think, probably something that's been tough for the civil court.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've been dealing with a lot, unfortunately, within these last 6 weeks or so. We've had Ahmaud Arbery George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and now Rashard Brooks. I think there's another person in there too. I can't remember. Anyway, it's too many. What if I want to get each of your thoughts about, as you've heard about these things, you know, as mothers, how you heard about these things. So start off with that. First, tell us about what you thought about.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm going to say this. I think Ahmaud Arbery, when Ahmaud Arbery's case, when I first heard the news of it, I think I saw it on social media and I said, no, this couldn't, you know, be right. Like, and you know, and you're just hoping that it's fake news. And as I started to see it more, I read about it, you know, and at the time no one had been arrested. And at the very first instance of me hearing about it, they hadn't even released the video. But I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me, just reading about it. And then when they released the video, I cried real tears, Captain Hunter. I cried real tears for my son because I said, I am a Black woman with a Black husband raising Black children, specifically a Black son. And so, you know, this is not a game to me. And it's not even a news article that I read and I can just, I felt almost as if the life had been sucked out of me for a few days. And to think George Floyd was on the horizon. Like I remember being just down and feeling like I was in just a comatose, debilitating state after they released the video of Ahmaud Arbery. Just thinking, how could officials have sat on this without doing anything? You know, so that's how I felt initially about Ahmaud Arbery being a mother, you know, and from a legal standpoint, I'm like, wow. But Sheree, I'll let you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the same thing with Shantae. You know, I worked in Georgia for 9 years, for about nine to 9.5 years. His case happened in South Georgia. And so for me, when I first heard about it, I was shocked. I was shocked that they kept punting. The prosecutors would punt it to someone else. They would punt it to someone else. And then they would take their position to try to say why this was a lawful killing. It was so unimaginable to me that I almost thought it was not real. And like Shantae, I saw the video and I almost hate that I ever watched the video because I could never, ever get it out of my head. And I told Shantae, when I was in Atlanta, my husband and I were newly married, we would always go inside of construction homes on a Sunday to just look and see what they were doing in these homes, to see what home, to dream and say, oh, one day we're going to get this home. I can think about tons of construction homes my husband and I would go into when we were looking for homes. I mean, this wasn't that long ago before I moved back to Birmingham, Alabama. And so for me to think that I could go into a construction home or my husband could go in there and then the next thing his life could be taken, it was unimaginable to me. And as a prosecutor, I thought we've always held that job that you always do the right thing at the right time for all the right reasons. And my sister and I have both held that in our hearts. And we've always dismissed cases when cases needed to be dismissed. When we were both prosecutors, we talked about that and we held people accountable when they needed to be. So for me, it was a real travesty of justice to see that the prosecutors did not hold them to justice. The only reason why those people were finally arrested is because Black Americans, we put our foot on the gas. They kept pumping it into social media and they opened up this wound, this issue, and then finally someone said, oh, okay, well, I guess we need to take a better look and arrest them. If they had never put this on social media, I believe those two killers would still be out.
And Captain Hunter, you'll have to kind of interrupt us, you know, at times when you get us started about this. So if I'm talking too much, let me know. But I want to say this, what Sheree said about the prosecutors punting. I think that was one of the most hurtful things for me. But it goes on a lot, you know, sadly. So it goes on a lot. But that's why our community has got to understand the power of a vote. Prosecutors are elected officials. They are elected all across the U.S. we've got to understand electing good prosecutors, because prosecutors have way too much power, way too much power to misuse it and abuse it.
When they have more power than the judge.
Absolutely. The most powerful person in the courtroom is the prosecutor. And I say that all the time. You know, it's not me as the judge. It is the prosecutor, because they have the ability to amend a charge, reduce a charge, flat out dismiss it, or to indict you on additional charges and have you arrested. Well, when I was in the prosecutor's office years ago, I remember there was I prosecuted a case where an officer beat up inmates in our county jail. And it was a hard case because a lot of people did not want that officer to get charged. And I tried that case. And I remember my closing argument before the jury. My closing argument was, ladies and gentlemen, this is a sad day for Birmingham, because I'm asking you to hold up the person who we call to serve and protect. But I'm asking you to hold this man accountable, because we can't have law enforcement beating up the inmates in the jail. And they held him accountable and he was found guilty. But I remember feeling good as a prosecutor, because I said, people will know that I am about holding anybody accountable for a job. And that's what we've got to make sure prosecutors do. You hold people accountable regardless of who it is.
Very good. Very good. I want to say hi to everyone in here. Scott, Sibonet, James, Karen, and I think Tiffany's here as well. Some former officers I work with, and just some good friends. Also, AWO. He's good. AWO, you know who you are. So thanks everyone for coming on to the podcast. I am going to be having some, we are going to be asking questions and things like that. So please make sure that you guys have some questions. I see your question, Scott. I'm going to get to it in a second here. I wanted to ask, they talked about the prosecutors, and what really bothered me about the Ahmaud Arbery case was, I believe, the second prosecutor. No, the second prosecutor who wrote that letter. Did you all read that letter?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that letter? I never went to law school, but I'm like, this can't, I couldn't even believe what I was reading, but go ahead.
So for me, I thought, first of all, it was a complete conflict of interest. If you're not taking the case because you feel like it's a conflict of interest, then why would you write a letter to attempt to persuade the next person in one way or the other? I thought he was definitely, if it was so clear to me that he was trying to help his friend out, to help them, because he was attempting to persuade them before they even had an opportunity to investigate the case. Because if you get a letter like that, if I had been the prosecutor and I pick up the file and I get a letter like that from the previous person, then that could change my view of the case before I actually get into it. It could definitely change my view of the case. So I think, honestly, he tried to try that case right in that letter. He tried to try that case right in that letter. And I'm hoping at some point that there can be ramifications for that, that there can be sanctions for those types of things. I know Shantae is laughing.
I get it. Because I don't want her to go too far, because she is the our go too far twin all the time. And so yeah. We get your point. I think we get your point, and you can end it there.
Thank you.
Well, look, I agree. I'm wondering if there's sanctions coming his way as well. I did read there was some body of prosecutors who condemned him. I read that where he was condemned for doing that. So I don't know what you can and cannot say, but I'm going to say it. I think that he should have some trouble coming his way. As you mentioned, the vote is very important. He should be voted out of office for that. I mean,
absolutely.
I read it like two or three times. I'm like, I can't believe what I'm reading here.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And if you recuse yourself, then there should be no further comment concerning the evidence or the case. If I ever enter an order of recusal on a case, I don't get an opportunity to comment on the witnesses, the credibility, or the evidence in a case. And trust me, every prosecutor knows that. Everybody, every lawyer, every judge, and every prosecutor understands that a recusal or a conflict of interest, that means that you will no longer comment on anything in the case.
Well, apparently every prosecutor but one in the U.S. So your thoughts, you know, after that, of course, we get George Floyd. And I was very traumatized, as you all were, when I watched the first Ahmaud Arbery. And then I really had a hard time sitting through George Floyd because It was so, you know, Arbery was so fresh. So can I get your thoughts about just getting hit with a back-to-back on that?
2020, wow, this has been, you know, this has really been a time. I still haven't to this day watched the entire almost 9 minutes of George Floyd because I can't. Like, I absolutely can't. And whenever I see probably a few seconds of the officer kneeling on his neck, that's all I can take. And, you know, again, I think it just, but George Floyd, I think for America and for me, that was the tipping point. Like, that was just it. That was really it. And, you know, but we're not the only ones, y'all, you know, who feel like this. Like, I have a lot of friends in law enforcement. That was the tipping point for them. They don't appreciate it. They don't like it. They just, more of them need to speak up when these things are happening, when they're on patrol and, you know, with the patrol stops with their buddies and these things are happening. But it's unbelievable about George Floyd. Just unbelievable. Right now, I am still filled with anger. Grief, because I still think I'm grieving the way George Floyd died, because I understand that George Floyd could also be my husband, my son, you know, and Captain Hunter, when you think about all of these cases, we're not talking about mass murderers. We're not talking about serial killers. We are talking about the accusation for George Floyd was a counterfeit $20 bill, And what people have to understand is, even if he was guilty of murder, the police, they don't get an opportunity to execute him. They don't get that opportunity, even if he was guilty of murder. But a $20 counterfeit bill, you know, that's amazing to me. Amazing.
Yeah, I feel the same way Shantae said. Basically, the floor, I watched the entire 8 minutes, 46 seconds. I watched it. And it is something that I will never forget. I will never forget. It sticks with me. I think it just really, honestly, the Ahmaud Arbery case was very difficult for me. The George Floyd case took me to the end. It took me over the edge. It just really took me over the edge. And I started thinking about my son. I started thinking about my husband. I started thinking about my daughter, because I don't think women are immune from all of these things. And it started making me think about the sheer audacity of some police officers and the power that they think they have. And we need to make sure that that there are psychological tests that are administered before someone becomes a police officer. We need to make sure that they understand that power and that they're using it for the right reason. And also, I think we need to go back to, sometimes the police officer can do more community policing in the regards of, if it's a $20 counterfeit bill, go up and talk to the person. I don't think that's enough. That's not enough to even really probably put somebody in handcuffs. But let's say they're being rowdy about it. Certainly putting your foot on their neck. I don't think putting your foot, nobody put their foot on the neck of the Unabomber. And he killed, you know, 3 or 4 people. Nobody put their foot on the neck of the guy who went inside the church in South Carolina. He's still living. And so there is a sheer racial injustice issue that's going on. And so I think the George Floyd case, it brought everything to light for me. And I will never be the same person after what happened. I will never be the same person. I will even see things differently from the bench. And that's not to say for the worst, but I will see things more clear from the bench because of this.
Why now? I've been asking that question for a lot of different people. We've had video, we saw essentially people get killed before, right? Philando Castile, we saw Eric Garner, we saw Alton Sterling, Terrence Crutcher. Why now? Why was this such a boiling point, a tipping point, the straw that broke the camel's back?
You know, I think that's a great question. I don't think it should have been. I don't think we should have just seen George Floyd and have just lost it. But the reality is that we did. And I think COVID, sitting down, actually paying attention to mankind, looking at things, made America open their eyes a little more, because everybody's always busy. Everybody's running here, running there. Oh, they see this on the news, but then it's another day, another dollar. I think we were all sitting down and we had an opportunity to look and see and say, well, I'll be, this is absolutely insane. Enough is enough. And I honestly think the pandemic probably made people sit down and say, enough is enough. I don't know.
I have to agree with you, Sheree, because I don't know the answer if it's not the pandemic quite, because you're right. We have so many other countless names. Like, this has happened a number of times. You know, I was watching something with my kids the other day and they mentioned probably 10 people, like 10 people, like within the last few years. And I had known the name of every last one of them. And so I think there is something about us being in this pandemic, not having other distractions, and having to sit in this moment and experience this as a nation. And I think
you're right. And I think having to watch something for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, I think it gives you a new perspective, because it seemed like a lifetime for that man while his knee was on Mr. Floyd's neck. I think the 8 minutes and 46 seconds transformed people and changed people, because when I was watching it, I'm thinking, well, when is this going to be over? Enough is enough. And it just went on and on and on. So I think an 8 minutes, 46 second video also probably made people just stop and look.
In those two particular cases that we talked about, what are your thoughts on the chances of getting convictions in both of those cases, Arbery and Floyd?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing. And I think people understand this more now, that just because you're charged does not mean that you're going to get that there will be a conviction. I think our better chances are to make sure that we have a fair and impartial jury, which means that maybe those cases will have to be relocated to other jurisdictions, but to make sure that we have a fair, impartial jury and a judge who will call it down the middle, as we say, you know, who won't lean to one side or another. And, you know, and Sheree says this all the time when she was in private practice, that's really all you want in a courtroom. Whether you win or lose a case, you want a judge that's going to call it down the middle. Now, I do believe that there will be a conviction on, I believe there'll be a conviction on George Floyd. I'm prayerful that there will be a conviction on Ahmaud Arbery's case.
I would like to say, I believe there will be a conviction on both, but if I can be honest with you, if you saw Philando Castile, a man who had been stopped by the police 49 times before he died, 49 times, and then he was shot in front of his girlfriend and his baby daughter, and there was no convictions, I'm left with feeling like I pray there is a conviction, but I'm not all the way there saying, oh yeah, because we saw this video that there will be one. I think, as Shantae said, the jury will probably have to be moved out of the county where they are. And then I think they also will have to be sequestered. I think they're going to have to be away from their family and sequestered, no TV. I think that we're going to have to make sure that there is a judge that is fair and impartial,
and sometimes not running for office, not up for re-election.
Because I will be honest with you, with the Ahmaud Arbery case, one of the things that made me very concerned, I think it's great that that it has now been handed over to the Cobb County DA's office, who is a Black female. However, it is an election time for her. And I think when there are election times for people, sometimes we do things for the sake of politics. Now, and I'm not saying this lady is going to do that. I don't know her. I pray to God.
Let's not even put her in a position to have to make a decision.
Exactly. I pray to God she doesn't do that. But I think we shouldn't even put her in a position to make that, to even make that happen. So
I'll also say this. I'm sorry. We always cut each other off. But I pray there is a conviction on those cases for the sake of this land, because I'm not so sure that it will be a good day if they are not convicted. I think, you know, we've let far too many not guilties go, you know, starting with Trayvon Martin, well before Trayvon Martin. I don't believe that I don't believe that the Black community can afford to hear not guilty much more.
I don't think so.
That was going to be my next question, you know, about the protests and everything like that. And I don't think that we can hear that either. And unfortunately, I think that we have to get to the place where the white population can't afford to hear that either. I mean, they've got to understand. I think that has been driving what a lot of the white protesters behind us as well, because this is their, I mean, police reform is about reforming not just for the Black community, right? So there's plenty of white persons who have had their loved ones killed because they've been suffering from mental illness, or mm-hmm. because they were harassed because they were homeless or something like that. Uh-huh. So I think that there's a lot that has to change with all that type of stuff. So I want to get questions from the audience. So if you guys got any questions, I'm going to get to your question in a second there, Scott. So if you guys could start shooting me some questions, I would appreciate it. We've been on about 45 minutes now. Time has been flying. I don't want to hold these ladies. I didn't ask you how long you guys had. I don't want to hold you all night, but.
Oh, I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm fine as well.
All right.
Yeah.
So before we get to their questions, any audience questions, I want to ask you about another controversial case, and that would be the Rashard Brooks in Atlanta, Georgia, there, the shooting there. What are your thoughts about that? I've had some very spirited conversations. Of course, my own background as a law enforcement officer, I taught defensive tactics. And so I've had some very spirited conversations about the legality of that particular shooting.
Well, I don't know if Shantae and I would even agree on some of this. I hope we will. So I'll just see if you agree with me on this. I told her when this first happened, I don't want people to make these cases, the George Floyd and the Rashard Brooks case, because they are different cases. And I think we should know that they are different cases. They're different cases in the sense that George Floyd was not fighting with anybody. He was, his foot
was unarmed, whereas the taser, by virtue of Mr. Brooks grabbing the taser, he becomes armed.
So let me say, so my feelings are, just to be quickly about this on the Rashard Brooks case, I think we cannot, there is an issue when you fight with police officers. It's almost just, it's almost suicide, fighting with the police officers. I think there is a potential issue with the fight that led. However, he was unarmed. He had once the taser is shot a second time, the taser is no longer a threat. And that officer knew that. It was a DUI case at best, a DUI, which is a misdemeanor. They had his driver's license. They had his car. I think if you saw him running, we've got to think about policing a little differently. You could have put a warrant out for him, and I'm sure you would have gotten him the next day. He would have come back to get his car. I don't think there's any lawful justification to shoot him in the back once he's running. They were not in any fear or danger. Also, I think it was sheer negligence of the officer. I looked at the cars. There were multiple people in the drive-through, and so we're just going to start shooting on a DUI case? Shooting, and what if that bullet would have hit other people? So I think those are some negligent considerations there. But like I said, I think it's a very different case. I think there will be probably a harder chance of conviction in the Rashard Brooks case, but I still don't think he was justified for shooting him in the back.
You know, I think Keisha Lance Bottoms said it best, and not that I always agree with everything any one person says, but I think she did say it best. There is a difference in what you can do and what you should do. And I think that's, for me, I think that Mr. Brooks made some really bad decisions in that he fought the police, he grabbed a taser, he pointed a taser at the police. I mean, those are all things that, you know, and I know people don't want to hear it, but those are things that you can't do. Like you can't do that and expect the situation to end up safely for you. I just wish that the officers would have said, you know what, this is a DUI, he's running away. Let's go back to the station and put a warrant out on it. I wish that's what they did.
Yeah, because I think what basically happens is if you get in a scuffle, and I'm not making light of this, but you get beat up, he overpowered two officers, and then their ego got the best of them. They felt a bit embarrassed, and so I felt like the adrenaline was flowing. And not only that, let me go further. this officer had some other issues. He had some previous disciplinarian actions. I think maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, this officer had actually shot someone and punctured his lungs. And so, I think there were better choices that could have been made. And sometimes even in the heat of the moment, we've got to think about better choices. I mean, is it worth pulling out a gun once the taser was shot twice? I don't think so.
And Sheree and I have differed slightly on this case. We've differed a little bit on this case, but I want to say this, Captain Hunter. I have several friends in law enforcement who've been my friends for years as a prosecutor, and I met them all when I was a prosecutor. So I was talking to a few of them a few days ago, and I asked, have you ever shot anybody? Have you ever killed anybody? A great majority of these officers, and they're all African-American officers, they said, no, I've never, and these are officers who have been police officers for 15 plus years. They said, no, I've never killed anybody. Nope, never even shot, like had to shoot anybody. And so sometimes they haven't been working in a school their whole police, their careers. They've been in communities. And so what makes their policing different than a lot of other officers? And so I think we just need to talk about policing practices, community policing, reform. But the Rashard Brooks case is different for me than George Floyd.
Very good. So I want to mark this time down that I got these twin judges to disagree slightly. I'm very, very glad about that.
Because I wanted to add, the Rashard Brooks case is different from the Floyd's case, but the result is the same. It was unjustified. I know Shantae may or may not disagree with that.
I didn't say I disagree with that. I want my last comment to be what Keisha Lance Bottom said. There is a difference in what you can do and what you should do.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt now because you guys are going to keep trying to one-up each other. I can see that. I can see that coming right now. So I want to keep on, and I'm going to get to your question in a second here, Scott. Let's see here. I want to go with Karen's question first. She's a former detective, worked with me, or I worked with her. As judges, is there a concern that if there's a conviction not rendered, that there would be mass riots? Put this up on the screen here, and that a conviction will be rendered just or not just to placate the people? And that's probably talking about Brooks and George Floyd, right? Are you concerned that there'll be mass riots if there's no convictions in these cases that we're talking about?
Me personally, I'm very concerned that there will be mass rioting across this, across the U.S. if there is not a conviction, in these cases. But what I'm not so concerned about is that will a conviction be rendered just to kind of placate or pacify us? We've never been so lucky. That'll never happen.
I was going to jump in and say, I can't think of a conviction that was placated on behalf of Black people. So there won't ever be a conviction that was placated on behalf to just make Black people happy. Absolutely.
No. So that if they are convicted, then I think it will be a deliberate and justified conviction.
So this is Scott. He asked this question a while ago. He wanted to go back to you guys talking about the lying. Please ask the judge to expand on her observation that cops lie under oath. Are these liars disciplined by their higher ups?
I think that is a great question. I don't know. I know that I have not followed through on cases that I have thought the officer were lying, and we dismissed those cases in the DA's office, and we sent letters to the police department. I didn't necessarily follow up. I felt like I had done my job as a prosecutor by dismissing the case, or by saying, no, we're not going to use this officer, or by letting the defense attorney know. I always handed over evidence that I thought was very questionable. I can think of one case in particular that I tried many years ago where, it really sounded as if he was cursing and beating up the defendant, but then he kept turning the tape back on. And the defendant said that he had been beat up, he had been doing all these things, but you didn't see it on the tape until you listened to the whole tape and there's a click. And then the tape goes off, and then there's a click, and the tape goes on. And so I found that officer not to be credible at all. That's just one particular case that I can think of. I can think of cases where officers, when they're doing photo lineups, and they're suggesting by pointing that they won't necessarily record the photo lineup that they're doing with the victim, but then they'll just write it out and have the victim sign it. And then when I, then as a defense attorney, when I go and I talk to the victims, and they're like, well, I never said that was the person. I said that could have been a person. I wasn't sure, but the officer kept tapping on picture number three. And so the officer was like, yeah, you know, if you choose that picture. And so those are things that that I have seen. And so, yes, when that has happened with me as a prosecutor, I've always dismissed the case, or I've always allowed the opposing party to know about it. But I think that's a good thing. I don't know if they were ever disciplined. I know that our office did send the information over to the police department.
Let me just jump in here. What about the officer from that point going forward? What their testimony? Would you use that officer again? I mean, is that not?
Once a liar, always a liar to me. As far as an officer on a case, and I have never used that officer again. And I remember on another case, I had an armed robbery case where we thought the officer was lying. The judge thought the officer was also lying, and we stopped in the middle of the hearing, and the judge said, he cannot come back in here. He is not credible from this point. And so I have never used another officer where I've never used another officer as a prosecutor when I thought that officer was not. And let me say this, it hasn't been 100 officers. You know, it's been, you know, those two or three that you know that's there that have lied. And I'm not even talking about the officers that thought they had the right person, did the right thing, but it wasn't the right guy. I'm not even talking about those. I'm talking about those officers that explicitly lied about things that harmed defendants while they were trying to get statements from them.
Is lying in your state under oath by a police officer grounds for termination?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know that. I don't know. I mean, I know getting caught in a lie under oath is grounds for perjury, which is a criminal, which is a criminal case and should be grounds for termination. I will say in Jefferson County, and I can't think, this is when I was a prosecutor, and even now, the DA's office here, if there is any indication that that a police officer in whatever way has not been forthcoming or forthright with anything, they will dismiss the case, and more than likely any other cases involving that officer, if they can't be made with other officers, they let those go too. And that's to keep the community, the trust of the community. So,
yeah, and I think you're right about that. I tried a case with a prosecutor that worked with Shantae when I moved back to Birmingham. And there was an officer that seemed extremely untruthful on some things. And the prosecutor turned it over, told me what he thought was the issue with it. We still tried the case because he thought he still had enough information to go on my client. But luckily it worked out for my client.
I want to get to some more questions here. Did I get all the questions? I think I did. Okay. I wanted to ask you, we talked about before about the
slight. I asked you a question from Tiffany Bosco.
Is there a question here? I thought it was just a statement. I'm sorry, Tiff. I was kind of breezing through it. There are some questions.
I just see some question marks at the end.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry, Tiff. She's gonna hurt me. He was shot. Tiffany says he was shot in the back because he turned with a weapon in his hand. If that taser, obviously we're talking about Brooks, if that taser made contact with the officer would have been rendered incapacitated. Brooks could have taken the officer's gun and then killed them both. And who knows who else, I guess. And it's dangerous to say that after a suspect fights with you, takes your taser, let him go and run away with your taser. These are points that we all made last week when we had this discussion. Then drives away and kills someone when he's under the influence, right? So this is, I think this goes back to the Lance Bottoms situation, mm-hmm. where she talks about you know, things that you can do and should do and all that type of stuff. And this is exactly the point that I made. Tiffany is currently
current law enforcement officer.
She is, and she's a taser instructor, taser and defensive tactics instructor. Okay. So this is her area of expertise. This is why, you know, as law enforcement officers, I took the stance that I took. Tiffany's taking the stance that she takes that it was justified what he did according to legal standards. Mm-hmm. You all, the prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, you have a greater understanding of what goes on in the courtroom. But the way that we're looking at it is, that's the way that we're looking at it.
Well, you know, I don't entirely disagree with y'all. You know, I don't entirely disagree with you. And that's where I say I think Sheree and I are a little probably off on this one. Just my motherly instinct right now, the fact that George Floyd died, Ahmaud Arbery, it's just too much, you know, right now. And so I will admit that my emotions are tied into Rayshard Brooks more so than looking at that, you know, with just clear eyes. But yeah. That's why I've said, you know, I think there are some issues with the Brooks case.
Yeah, and I understand about woulda, shoulda, coulda, but we have to deal with, you know, one of the things they tell us as a prosecutor is we can't come down and say the Martians did it. We have to go off the evidence. And the evidence was that he did have a taser. The taser had already been fired twice, so it would no longer have been rendered a threat. And he was on foot. So he couldn't have gotten back in his car and killed someone. The police officers were still there by the car. He was on foot. He had, I believe he had even asked them something about walking around the corner to some family member's house. And so the reason for me, if he had gotten in his car and, you know, started driving, then the facts would be completely different. And I may be thinking of something else. But the reality is he was running away on foot. And so for me, and I don't think this is an easy case. I don't think they're going to walk in and get a guilty verdict in like 30 minutes or anything. I just think for me, the facts are that he was not a threat after he ran away.
Okay. Okay. Scott says, once a liar, always a liar. These are sworn officers. Even one liar is too many. I wanted to ask you again concerning the, we talked about the psychological test, and I've heard somebody else said that in another interview that I was on. And of course, being in Connecticut, I'm assuming, and I was always assumed that the parameters for becoming a law enforcement officer are the same throughout the country, more or less. And so do you know, and I don't know if you do or not, are there psychological tests to become a police officer in Alabama? Because there are in Connecticut.
There could be. And I'm going to leave it at that. I wish there were, but there absolutely could not be.
You know, I was talking to a police officer the other day, and I don't know if they are or not. I think if they are, they're very basic, because the police officer said to me that there needs to be more, there needs to be psychological testing, there needs to be stronger testing. And so that led me to believe that if there are, it's at a very, very minimum. So I'm not sure if there are, but apparently I think there needs to be a higher level of testing.
And fair enough. Karen, and Karen, I understand the comments that y'all are making. However, you know, too much is going on. And the problem is that we're seeing videos and reading other news articles of identical situations with white offenders who make it home or either to the jail. And I think that is the issue right now in America for us, for Black mothers, Black fathers, Black women, Black people. The issue for us and all of this, and why we probably can't really see this through your lens, is because we're seeing where identical situations, or even worse, they are making it home or to the jail. And all we're saying is just let our sons make it home or to the jail. And I'm not even saying I agree with what Rayshard Brooks did. Look, I will say this. Well, When Rayshard Brooks was fighting the officers, that was time for them to do what they needed to do, you know, at that point. And I don't understand how he overpowered two of them, but I'm not saying Rayshard Brooks was right in the least bit, but we're at a very emotional state right now. We just want to see some, we just want to see black men make it to the jail or make it home. You know, that's it. That's it. I'm not saying that you could have loaded the charges up on him. He could have done time, you know, 12 months in the county jail for it. But we can't take too much more of killing. But he didn't make the right decisions. Now, I am definitely not saying he made the right decisions. So.
No, he didn't make the right decisions, but the officer didn't make the right decision in the end either. And I understand, I can respectfully disagree with Karen's post, you know, and we keep going back to could have carjacked someone, but I deal in reality and he did not. He didn't get a chance to. He didn't make it. He could have done. The officer could have done something completely different too. And, you know, and I go back to other cases, you know, I go back to the case in South Carolina where the guy goes inside and shoots 9 people and he makes it to get a burger. They give him a hamburger on the way. And so for me, there is no convincing me that you're going to tell me that it was lawful for Rayshard Brooks to have died.
Okay, Sheree, do you remember you sent me an article last week from USA Today about a young man that went to a club, shot maybe 7 people, and he got away? And we were like, what do you mean he got away?
They're like, still looking for him. That's
yeah, do what you do to us. Like, find him. That's who you pop. Like, find him and pop him. You know, he shot 7 people. I'm becoming a little emotional about that. So,
all right. We'll
yeah, being drunk, is that still an excuse to get killed? I'm sorry.
Well, I certainly agree that this is an emotionally charged time, and I think we all want fairness and justice, and it, for a number of reasons, it doesn't seem to be that way. Scott Rushing says, "I'm not defending Rayshard. I'm saying use deadly force was tactically and morally wrong." Scott is a Scott unfortunately had his son killed by police. He was on my podcast a few Sorry. Weeks back. Yeah. So he likes you guys. So Karen's got another question, but my question to the judges is what do they think the police officer's responsibility to the public is when they let offenders leave?
Well, we got to talk about what offenders you let leave. Here, we're talking about a low-level misdemeanor DUI at best, DUI at best offender. I'm not telling you to let the serial killer, the guy that just broke in someone's house, held up everybody in the house, raped a little girl, you know, do this. I'm not saying let those people live. What I'm saying is I think that there is a point in time that we can do a little bit we can put ourselves in certain positions and think about things. You know, we have an uncle that's a police officer. And a few years ago, there was a young lady that he stopped for a DUI a few years ago. And I don't know what she said or what happened, but he took her in the car and took her home and said, "You can't go get your car until tomorrow." She didn't get arrested. And all I'm saying, and this was a white female, and my uncle is black. And all I'm saying is, why can't that same thing be extended to Rayshard Brooks in the sense that once he got away, once they, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't have tried to tase him again. That's perfectly fine once he got away. But once he was no longer a threat, this is a misdemeanor case. We're not talking about somebody going inside the Wendy's, shooting up the whole place, blowing, taking the cash register out and running out and it's 10 bodies left. Yeah, don't let him get away. But a misdemeanor, is this how we're going to go about handling things? It just is not morally right. And as Scott said, it's not tactically right.
So here's where I would agree that things have to change going forward, right? And this is a difficult time in what police perform now. But under the current law that it is or was at that particular time, I'm not sure that they did anything wrong. And I know that this, would I have handled it that way? Probably not. I probably would not have. As I mentioned, for all the things before, I just don't think this is the case to hang our hat on. I think it goes again with the emotional charge that we're all operating under. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be very careful and cautious that if we put this under that particular umbrella and we go to court and everything's explained, as you all very well know, under the legal definitions of killing and justified use of force, and they put police experts on there who talk about exactly what Tiff and I would talk about, you know, we're charged up, the adrenaline's flowing. Okay, we know now that both of those taser cartridges were fired, but in the heat of the moment, they might not have known that. The officer might not have known that. And so he could have been operating under the fact that there's another charge, a cartridge in this taser, with another firing. And so he can reach over his shoulder, shoot, incapacitate me, take out my eye, serious physical injury, and all that type of stuff. So there's a lot of things that could be going on. And I think that I agree
with you on that. And yeah, that's why I said, I'll preface this with, I'm looking at this through emotional lenses, you know, for Rayshard Brooks. But I totally agree with everything that you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I I'm going to be very sensitive. I'm in the same mode as everyone else. This is a very sensitive time. I'm sorry for the family, but I just don't think that this goes with George Floyd. This doesn't go with Ahmaud Arbery. This is not the case. When we talk about Black Lives Matter and all that kind of stuff, I don't even think they'll get a conviction. I guess they charge with 11 charges or something crazy like that. I mean,
also, we're talking about, you know, politics and all, you know, I think those charges came very swiftly, you know, for political reasons also.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And I don't want the community to be set up for a letdown. Mm-hmm. So, let's see. A warrant. This is another former, officer as well. I'm going to call him Sean, former Sergeant Sean. A warrant would have been the way I went, as opposed to shooting the man, even if the taser made contact, a second officer was there. So people have been saying this, and this is where we get into the could haves, should haves, and all that kind of stuff. And yesterday, a friend of mine, we had a long conversation about this, and they're saying, you know, the officer could have let him go, and okay, the officer runs away. And I'm sorry that the guy runs away. The guy runs away from the officer. He's got his taser. And I posed this question, and I want to get your thoughts on this. So you're at the Wendy's drive-thru at 11 o'clock, and you see two officers fighting with someone. The officer's taser gets taken, and the guy runs away. And you say, and you watch the officers. Well, hey, he's gone. And then you walk back to the car and then drive away, or tow the guy's car. What would you think about those particular officers? What would be your thought process? Is that what we want? Is that what we want?
Well, I don't think that's what would have happened. I don't think they would have just done that. I think they would have called back up. They would have continued, if they were fit, they would have continued to run. I've seen most officers do. They would have called back up and they would have kept on it. So I think, you know, sometimes you're just like, lackadaisical. I don't think it would have happened like that at all. I think they would have called more backup. And to be honest with you, as many officers as they have on the beat in Atlanta, they probably would have gotten them a block up the street. Because I, you know, I'm familiar with this area in Atlanta. They probably would have gotten, it was near the AU Center, I think. They probably would have gotten the guy like a block up the street. They obviously needed backup if he overpowered two officers. And so they would have just called him. I think the point that I'm saying is one of the charges that they have is aggravated assault. And there has to be imminent harm. After he started running, there was no imminent harm. And I understand that we don't want criminals running on the street, but I also think we got to think about the criminals. And I understand DUI kill people, but he wasn't in a car at this time. We have to be rational and think about this. He was not in a car when he was running away. And as much as we want to make DUI to be the bad thing, it's not always when he's on foot. If he's in a car, that's a different thing. And it is a misdemeanor.
DUI in a car, I despise DUI cases, you know, when they're in a car. But I agree with Sheree on this. When we're talking about a man outside of a car, you know, I think, you know, at that point, the threat level has, you know, definitely decreased at that time.
I think AWOL or Sean said it best, put a warrant on him. I mean, I think the guy had some issues.
I don't know about that. I mean, you know, let me tell you. I don't know about that. I understand pursuit of him during this. Like, the warrant takes time. You got to come to my house. I got to sign, you know. Or I'm thinking about a search warrant. Okay. I agree with that.
I'm saying don't give up.
That's exactly what I said. I wish they would have done. They just would have put a warrant out for him.
Yeah.
You know, and go to court and ask the judge to give him more time because of what he did. Because those are the types of stories that when the prosecutor tells me that someone has fought with the police, attempted to elude the police, they put other people in harm's way. Oh, those are things that I take into deep consideration when I'm sentencing a person, because I think I take it very seriously when you endanger the police or you endanger the public. And when I hear those things, then that is definitely crafted into my sentence that I give.
Let's talk about the training that you think needs to go forward. People are talking about defunding the police, abolishing the police. What are your thoughts on defunding, abolishing, and whether we need more training, less training, all that?
And Sheree and I will disagree on this. We need to stop.
Well, two times, everyone. I got him to disagree two times. Two times.
We're going to disagree.
Are you disagreeing about disagreeing? That's three times, everyone. Three times.
Stop using the term defund. Like, if we have to explain it, this is a bad campaign we got going. Let's stop using it. It is silly to try to say abolish police departments. We cannot. The police, anytime anyone is in any trouble, who do we all pick up the phone and call? It's the police department. So we want police officers. We want community helpers. We want the police here. We don't need to talk about defunding them. We don't need to talk about abolishing them. But we can talk about training and reallocation within the budget, but not cutting the budget. But maybe if you spent, you know, this amount for, you know, one aspect of training, well, let's move it here to train, how to deal with mentally ill defendants or arrestees. And those are the things that I think that how we need to craft the conversation. But when we keep saying defund, all we do is, well, that's not what we mean, And if you always have to explain what you mean, you have a bad speech.
Yeah, I think, Shantae, I don't disagree with some of it. Abolishing, we certainly don't want to abolish the police. And I think when people say defund, some people think that means to get rid of them. No, I don't think we need to get rid of the police officers. However, Shantae said when we are in trouble, who we call. And I think we want to call the police. But I was listening to something that Oprah on the Oprah show and Ava DuVernay said the other night, that she remembered seeing her daddy being handcuffed in their backyard when she was growing up because they thought he looked like a suspect. So right then and there, that changed her perception. They didn't call the police for anything. So I think not everybody calls the police. But however, one of the major things that I think that we have to do in Alabama, in the southern states, I'm not sure if this is the way in Connecticut, is stop putting young 20-something-year-old white guys in a predominantly black high crime area or a predominantly black area. Let's not even say high crime, a predominantly black area, and making them think it's okay because they're scared, they're nervous, they don't know how to talk to the community, they have no relation. And I think a lot of things are about relationships. If you feel like you have a relationship with the people that you are policing, then you won't be as quick to come in and turn the gun. You know, I've had many cases where there are, you know, 20-something-year-old white guys who are policing an all-black community, and they don't really know what to do. They have no connection. So I think that's number one. I think number two, as Shantae said, we need to start thinking about, in the DA's office, I worked in DeKalb. We had several units. for expertise. Like we had the domestic violence sexual assault unit, crimes against children unit. I think we need to really give some serious thought to police officers that deal with the homeless population, because they are seeing a great, if they're on the beat on patrol, they are seeing a great deal of individuals with mental health. We need to put money towards that. We need to put police officers that are responding to domestic violence disputes between parties. They need to give a great deal with that. And so I think we just need to reallocate the resources, but not get rid of the police. Just get rid of the bad ones that are there, because one bad one is too many. It's like what they say about lawyers. People make all these jokes about lawyers and talk about how horrible lawyers can be. Well, we don't need any lawyers taking people money, not helping to defend the rights of the Constitution for any of those. So we just need to make sure that we're allocating the right resources for the police.
Very good. Any thoughts on this? Mike Edwards says, can that be judged with the benefits of hindsight? It's what he thought through the moment through his eyes, right? I think, again, that's the Brooks case there. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I want to kind of move off of this Brooks thing, but Karen Cerruti says, he disabled two officers while drunk. I don't believe he was a threat to the general public. If he doesn't mind fighting with the cops, do you think he wouldn't mind doing whatever he has to do to get away? So I'm going to move off.
Let's move on.
We can, because Karen and I won't see eye to eye on that. We'll respectfully disagree. Respectfully disagree with Ms. Cerruti.
Because okay. I think Karen, and it may really be a life issue between us. Like, we're going to see things through different lenses, because I think I've had different life experiences by virtue of how I live, that I'm not scared of every black man running. And so I think that's just going to be key for me.
So Scott says, please ask the judges about civilian oversight, right? I talked to you guys and I wanted to ask about changes that you wanted to see. So changes, civilian oversight, transparency, gypsy cops. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, what's a gypsy cop?
Yeah, I don't know what a gypsy cop is, Scott, but talk to us about what your thoughts are about civilian oversight, transparency. You talked about getting rid of bad cops. How should police departments go about that and all that?
I think police departments need to, and I think now this is going to happen. I think now police chiefs and police departments are going to look at complaints a little more seriously. However, we do realize, though, that everybody who files a complaint, you know, it is probably not always a valid complaint, you know, because people are filing complaints because they're mad because they were legitimately and justifiably arrested. But I do think now the internal affairs divisions of police departments, I think that they're going to say, well, wait a minute, Officer Smith has had 16 excessive use complaints in the last week. Let's see what's going on. Whereas before,
no other place. I can't have 16 previous complaints and remain on the bench. You know, even if, you know, a few are found unfounded, there would start to be an investigation from the Judicial Inquiry Commission about why is Judge Grant getting 16 complaints. And so I think you're correct about that.
And, you know, a lot, Captain Hunter, of what we need to do are common sense things. Like, a lot of these things are just common sense things. And one of the main things that I think needs to happen, and what Sheree was saying, is that you've got to stop fearing people that you don't know or that you don't understand. Because simply, and I think a lot of that goes on, and especially where we are, we're in the South, a lot of that goes on. And you cannot place a young officer who has never even gone to school with anybody other than white kids. You cannot place him in an unfamiliar environment and expect him to be comfortable in that environment. And what we're saying is that's just common sense. Like, if you're going to place him there, you've got to pair him with an officer who's very familiar with that beat, an officer of color who's very familiar with the beat. These are just common sense.
You've got to get training. And I think Mike Edwards is asking, so will we just, when they call 911, say, what color are you, so we can send that officer? I hope you're being facetious about that, because that's definitely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, we have to have training. We have to make sure that those officers are getting in the community. You know, there are a lot of things that go on in the community, other events other than just going to the community when you respond to the police, when you respond to a complaint. If you know that's your beat, well, they have a fun day. They have a family day at the beat. Why can't they see you out there at the fun day, at the family day, when you're or when the kids are out of school, making sure the officer is making sure the kids get through the crosswalk? Why can't they see you there on certain times other than when it's time to arrest someone? That's all I'm saying. There needs to be training for these officers. Not that, oh, only Black officers need to work in Black areas. No, there needs to be.
Yeah, that's definitely not what we're saying. But I am saying, and I think everybody needs to take a look at this. It is easy to fear something that you're unfamiliar with, you know? And so if you don't have familiarity with it, then you need to become familiar if that's going to be where you are. And that just is what it is. And, you know, I'm going to say it because people fear Black men, like the world fears Black men. And so that's why I think it is very important that we have training, that we not stick young officers with no prior experience in areas where they are unfamiliar with the people that they are policing.
And I think we also need, back to your question, a couple of things. There needs to be a civilian review board. And I don't think this civilian review board should say, oh, this officer needs to be demoted. This officer needs to be fired. But I think the civilian review board can be members of the community when there are complaints that can come together and make recommendations. Because
the only thing I'll add to that civilian review board is that it should not be that it should not consist entirely of civilians. If there should be someone with law enforcement experience, there should be at least one, if not two, law enforcement officers on a civilian review board.
Well, I was on the
or a retired law enforcement officer on a civilian review board. And the reason why I say this is because it is easy for us, and I do admit this, it's easy for us to say what a police officer should have done. But hey, I do recognize that they are trying to get home to their families every night, and they should have that opportunity to do that safely. And so we can't Monday morning quarterback every decision that they have as civilians. And so
the
review board needs to have a law enforcement officer.
No, we can't Monday morning quarterback it. But I was on the city of Atlanta had a civilian review board years ago, and I was one of the members of the civilian review board. And there were people from all over the city that came to just make recommendations. And I'm not saying that's exactly what they should. They shouldn't be able to say, oh, this officer should be fired. But I think it also allows there's community awareness, and also there's an accountability factor, because part of the problem of the citizens is that they feel like they can go file a complaint and nothing else is known. This at least brings awareness. One thing I just want to mention to anyone, this is not just for Rashard Brooks. This is not just for Ahmaud Arbery. My sister and I live in a predominantly white area. We live in a predominantly white area. And about 2 weeks ago, my sister's alarm went off in her house. Her alarm went off in her house. She has a Black husband. Her husband told her because they couldn't, something happened where they could not get the alarm to stop from going off. And so they couldn't get in touch with the alarm company and the police were going to be dispatched. My sister's husband, who is a professional, who has never come into contact with law enforcement any before, he's an entrepreneur, owns his own business, great guy, told her, I'm leaving because I am not going to get shot in my own house when the police come here and they see me in this neighborhood and I can't prove to them that this is my house. I'm going to leave. You got a better chance of surviving. That happened 2 weeks ago. So that's the reality that we as Black people live in. That's our reality. And this is coming from my sister, who is a judge, and her husband, who's an entrepreneur, who are upstanding citizens. None of us are immune from this.
Thank you for telling my story.
Scott wrote back in, gypsy cops are those who have discipline problems in one department and are allowed to resign and get rehired by another police agency. It is an issue. Departments like to hire experienced cops, and for whatever reasons, happens in California and is discovered after the gypsy cops hurts a civilian. Connecticut doesn't have that. I didn't know that was what they call it, but Connecticut, that you can't do that here in Connecticut. But what are your thoughts?
Really? Wow, it happens all the time here. That officer that I told you that I prosecuted years ago when I was a prosecutor, he worked for two more smaller municipalities here as a police officer and was fired from both of them for excessive use, of course. So he was fired from the county and from two more other municipalities because of that. Gypsy, I didn't know that was the name for it, but I was just talking to another lawyer the other day. That's a huge problem. And that is a problem here in Alabama and as well, I guess, in other states as well. And I think what needs to happen with that is that police departments need to do a thorough background search, and they need to easily, when they find out why were you released, why were you fired from the Birmingham Police Department or the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, they need to really make a decision as to whether this person should join their force. But this happens a lot in Alabama.
I know it happens, and I'm always surprised at that. The guy who shot Tamir Rice was going to be rehired somewhere else.
Yes.
There was another kid, Laquan Rose, in East Pittsburgh. That officer had resigned from another department, and within 4 hours of being sworn in, shot Laquan Rose. I believe his name was Laquan Rose. His last name was definitely Rose. He shot him in the back, a 17-year-old kid. So I'm aware that it happens, but that is not something that we deal with here. I'm just want to try to scroll through these and make sure I get everyone's here. Scott asked about Colonel Grofin's American Killologist, who trains officers to be violent warriors. This idea... I did an episode about this, about the warrior cop versus the guardian. Your thoughts about that kind of stuff?
Never heard of him. He's a killologist who trains officers to be.
Well, he calls himself that. He tries to prepare officers mentally for the battles and the rigors of going out on patrol and have a mindset of not being a prey, but becoming the predator, essentially is what he's saying. And so there's been a push to get away from that type of teaching
and
go towards the more guardian community oriented type of police officers that you guys were mentioning. So I'm assuming we can move on from that because you're in agreement that we should not.
Concerns me a little bit. Killologists, that concerns me.
So Karen said she likes the idea of specialty units for patrol officers. I just want to go through this. Police officers are not trained to deal with mental health. And I want to talk about this just for a second. And it's an hour and 30 minutes in. I appreciate you guys. You guys just let me know when you guys get tired or whatever. And I want to hold you guys. But police officers are not trained to deal with mental health. And we had a CIT, Crisis Intervention Officer program in our department. I think last episode we talked about this. I think Tiff and I said, every department needs to model themselves after the Waterbury Police Department. And I actually highly agree with that because we had a critical incident team. I was one of the members of that team. And I'm understanding that other departments don't have, as you would say, I think that you were saying that they didn't do a better job with psychological tests, better jobs with background tests, background exams. And I don't know if you guys had some type of mental health with officers. You may not know about that, but that is something that we tried to institute. And I think that should become mandatory across the country that officers are trained with dealing with that.
As a judge, when I was a prosecutor a few years ago, maybe 12, 13 years ago, we didn't have as many cases dealing with mental illness. Now, I'm like, oh, my gosh, a great number of cases on my docket are cases where people are suffering from severe mental illnesses. And so I think, just the way even I judge has evolved over time, because when I first took the bench, there weren't as many as now 12 years later. And I mean, today I spent 3 hours handling just entering orders on cases for defendants who have severe mental health issues. So.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get through all these kind of comments here, and a lot of them are in agreement with you.
So let me ask Captain Hunter, I want to know, so about how many officers are in the police department at Waterbury?
We have about 300 or so now.
Oh, so it's a large police department.
Yeah, when I first started, it was 350. Then we, budget cutbacks to 270 or so, but now they're back up to 300. And so a lot of them are here, and listen, I brag about my department all the time because we had a good department. We were well-trained, critical incident team members. A lot of them are here tonight, former detectives and former sergeants, former lieutenants and captains and all that kind of stuff. So we had all this stuff. So in the state of Connecticut, like I've mentioned, you know, if you get fired or even if you resigned under investigation, you can't become a cop.
Wow.
So this stuff that's happening in other parts of the country, we're all kind of scratching our head. Like, why is this going on? You know, like you said, this 18, there's no way with this. And I'm going to let you guys go. We're going to wrap up on this point. So with the Minnesota officer, Derek Chauvin, 18 complaints in his record. There's no way in the world that we would have put this guy on the desk. We would have hit him somewhere in the building. He never would have been a training officer. It just wouldn't have happened. So we are scratching our heads. It's like, how did this happen? And, wow. You know, I'll say this again. This is, I know that the chief of police there in Minneapolis was, looked to be a person of color, and he's all differential and he's all sad and hugging the family and kneeling and taking his hat off and showing deference and all that. But listen, you had this chance 17 complaints ago to get this right. 15 complaints ago, you had this to get this right.
Absolutely.
And so you put this guy as a training officer to teach other people. What does that say? I mean, I know we hate to be critical a lot of times, but you know, we got to look and be honest about this. I'm going to leave it off right there. I know that guys are still want to chime in, and I really appreciate it. I held you guys for so long, and I don't want you guys husbands.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having us. And thanks to the audience for the questions and the comments. I enjoy it, and I love to be challenged. And so, you know, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And I just want to say your department sounds like a wonderful department. So
it was.
Best of luck to you.
It was. So I will try to have you guys back. And next time, I'm going to try to tell you guys apart. So don't tell me who you guys are. So we'll try to do that for next time. That'll be the challenge for next time.
Sounds good.
Yes. So again, a lot of thank yous. Thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. You guys are not on social media or anything like that, so nobody can follow you and all that kind of stuff, which is probably good. So that's good. And so thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. And we'll see you again. I know you guys got your 7-year-olds. Both of you got 7-year-olds and all that kind of stuff to get to. And I'm very happy that I can make you guys disagree on 3 different points tonight. I'm very, very proud of myself. Very proud of myself. So, ladies, we'll talk to you again. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And thanks so much for the audience.
So I'm going to stick around for a little bit if you guys want to talk for a little bit, chat. But we'll say goodbye to the ladies. Thank you so much. Okay. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye. All right. All right, so I think that was very well, very good. So listen, to all my former Waterbury guys there, you know, we really did come from a good department. You don't realize how good it was until you start looking around the country and seeing the craziness, the nonsense that was going on in other parts of the country, you know. And so as Tiff said somewhere up here, said we had a good department with, we've got a well-trained and well-led PD with great relationships with all of our communities. And I think that's really part of the problem that other people don't have. And I can remember sitting in some staff meetings, some command staff meetings. And there was some information that came out by the state of Connecticut when they partnered up with the Central Connecticut State University and did some traffic stop analysis. And when it came out, it hit the paper that the members of the African-American community and the Hispanic community said that some of these reports in here are not true. You know, the officers here are not targeting and excessively searching cars and of African-Americans in the Hispanic population, right? So when you have members of the African-American community and the NAACP and the members of the Hispanic coalition saying that there's no problems here, you know, I don't care what the data says, that there's no problems here. I think that that is very much something to be proud of. And I was in on those meetings, so I know that those happen. Let's see. Yeah, definitely, Karen. She says, I didn't realize how good PD 151 is. Proud of my PD. Yeah, it really is something to be proud of. You know, I've talked to some other PDs. And of course, like I said, we can look around and see what's going on. And we just did not have those problems and issues and stuff, you know. So not that we were perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But so listen, if there's no other questions or comments or anything like that, I'm going to be joining Scott this Saturday again. We had a roundtable discussion that's going to be going on at 1 o'clock on Saturday with the Issues Today broadcast radio show. I'm going to be joining him on that. He's doing a part two. So if you guys are available, I'll put that up again on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. So tune in for that. We'll have a nice discussion again. And I don't see any more questions or comments. So thank you guys once again. I hope I got everyone. Like I said, I can't see everyone who's logged in. So a thank you to everyone who logged in, Mike and Sean and Tiff and Karen and Scott and Sharon. And who else? Chris Casey was here, I think. Flip was here. Sibonet was also here. So thank you all to everyone. Thanks again. And we're going to cut it short or cut it off. Anyway, I got to go eat. I haven't eaten yet. So everyone, much love and peace. Guys, take care. Be safe. Wear your masks, all that kind of stuff. Take care.